Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for making the world part of your world by tuning into the show every day. We are grateful for your support. This year, the holiday season looks a lot different. Here at The World, we know what it's like to feel out of touch and uncertain about the future. That's why we strive to bring you honest stories that connect you with people around the globe. One thing you can be certain of is that The World team is dedicated to bringing you the coverage you need. Right now, though, the world needs you. Specifically, 578 dedicated listeners to donate $100 each to reach our goal. That's just $8.33 a month to support the stories we bring you each day. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we make the goal, and I know you'll get us there, I'll host a virtual celebration with the World team and send you an invite as a thank you for your support. Right now, go to theworld.org/give, and from everybody here at The World, thanks very much.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. A lot of big news surrounding the Middle East today. We start off with a diplomatic breakthrough. Israel and Morocco have agreed to normalize relations. President Trump announced the news today on Twitter. He called it a massive breakthrough for peace in the Middle East. Many would call that an overstatement. Still, this is the fourth Arab-majority country to agree to normalize relations with Israel in the past 4 months. As part of the deal, the Trump administration is reversing a longstanding U.S. policy by recognizing Morocco's claims over the disputed Western Sahara region. Samia Arazuki is a PhD candidate at the University of California, Davis, writing about Morocco.
Since 1975, both Democratic and Republican administrations have not taken this step. The Trump administration clearly has taken advantage of this last few months of its lame duck presidency to really break from the past and put the Biden administration in a difficult position.
Arazuki says it would be tough for President-elect Biden to reverse the decision on the disputed area of the Western Sahara because that could sink the entire agreement. Israel and Morocco have maintained lower-level diplomatic relations for many years. Still, the Israeli Prime Minister and King of Morocco both heralded today's agreement. Benjamin Netanyahu said, "This will be a very warm peace." King Mohammed thanked President Trump, and he mentioned the special ties between the Jewish community of Moroccan origin and Israel. Also today in the Middle East, a major development in Lebanon. Prime Minister Hassan Diab and three other government ministers have been charged with negligence leading to the explosion that rocked the port of Beirut this summer. The blast killed more than 200 people and left thousands injured. Joining me now to discuss today's developments is Karim Shahayeb. He's a Beirut-based journalist and non-resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. I asked him the significance of the charges brought by the prosecutor investigating the blast.
So there are several key points about why what happened today was extremely significant in the investigation. First of all, this is the first instance of where ministers and ex-ministers were charged and will be interrogated as accused. We've had a handful of interviews and investigations of ministers and former ministers related to the blast, but they were all done in the capacity as an eyewitness. Another big development, of course, is the fact that Prime Minister Hassan Diab was among those who were charged. And this is a significant development I don't think we've ever seen happen before.
And what's interesting is Hassan Diab, he resigned after the blast, but he's acting as a caretaker prime minister. So does that mean he's basically still prime minister?
A caretaker government is basically just like any other government, but on neutral gear. They just keep things going as is while lawmakers try to establish a new government. So we haven't had a full-fledged government in 4 months since Hassan Diab resigned after the Beirut blast in August. We have an incoming prime minister right now, but there are still negotiations. So technically, Hassan Diab is still in the Grand Serai and the ministers are still there, but they just keep things going at neutral gear.
What's been the reaction thus far to today's news in Lebanon to the fact that these charges have been brought?
There has been a lot of skepticism in general about the investigation. You know, Lebanon's judiciary is not independent, neither by law, neither in practice. So there's a lot of skepticism, whether it's from citizens that were affected or folks who weren't, about how effective this investigation will really be. At the same time, people were definitely surprised that the prime minister was charged and summoned. But there's lots of questions about other senior officials who have not been charged yet. For example, President Michel Aoun admitted to the press that he was aware of the ammonium nitrate, and he asked the judiciary and the officials to do what they have to do prior to the blast. There was a handful of ex-prime ministers preceding Hassan Diab in the 5 or so years that the ammonium nitrate was just lingering in the port. They weren't summoned either. So some people do think that Hassan Diab might actually be scapegoated, but there's also skepticism around the entire investigation in general, I think.
Do you think today's charges are the first step in tackling the political and economic corruption in Lebanon?
I don't necessarily think so, to be quite honest with you. I think the ammonium nitrate case is an example of the various nefarious practices that take place, the mismanagement, the negligence, and the corruption, of course. But corruption and, you know, illicit profiteering and all sorts of bad economic practices come in all shapes and sizes through all sorts of ministries and state institutions and otherwise, right? We're talking about decades and decades of these very dangerous practices, which has led to our economic crisis and which has led to this extreme deterioration. However, if the investigation is really independent and if it's really thorough and it really wants to get to the bottom of this, the port is a big example of financial mismanagement and corruption in Lebanon. So the investigation is a huge opportunity to further understand this. But of course, given that the judiciary is independent, given the power structures of the company, it's quite questionable to what extent we'll be able to uncover it in our current framework.
Karim Shahayeb is a Beirut-based journalist and non-resident fellow at the Trier Institute for Middle East Policy. Thanks a lot, Karim.
Thank you for having me.
And one more story we're following in the Mideast right now. The U.S. State Department is on course to greenlight a big weapons sale there. The United Arab Emirates wants to buy a fleet of advanced stealth fighter jets and weaponized drones. An effort to stop the sale failed to win enough votes in the U.S. Senate yesterday. The weapons deal is seen as part of a quid pro quo. The UAE gets state-of-the-art American firepower in exchange for its recognition of the State of Israel. That budding new relationship between the Gulf Kingdom and the Jewish state is enshrined in the Abraham Accords, brokered by the Trump administration back in August. Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri made the case for the weapons sale earlier this month.
We have increasingly worked closely with the UAE on defense issues, on the ground together, in the air together, in at least 6 different extended deployments. The UAE has been there.
If the deal goes through, the UAE would be making an exponential leap forward in terms of military might. The F-35 is America's newest fighter jet. It's built by Lockheed Martin in places across the U.S., including Missouri. It's flown by the U.S. military and some of its allies, but up to now, the only Middle Eastern country that had F-35s was Israel. Under U.S. law, all American weapons sales in the Middle East have to pass a litmus test. They cannot undermine Israel's qualitative military edge over its Arab neighbors. In a flurry of negotiations this year, Israel dropped its objections to the sale of jets to the UAE. The last step was to overcome objections in Congress.
This is the first time that we would sell these incredibly lethal, incredibly complicated technologies into the heart of the Middle East.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut is one of the lawmakers who supported legislation to block this weapons deal. Murphy says he agrees that the UAE is an important U.S. partner.
But for as many places as we cooperate with UAE, there are many points of division. And those points of division often involve the use of U.S. military technology against the interests of the United States.
The UAE has provided weapons, some of them U.S.-made, to militias in Yemen and Libya that are fighting forces supported by the U.S. Now the $23 billion sale of jets and drones can go through, but the first fighter planes will not be delivered to the UAE immediately. Poland purchased 32 F-35s in January, but it's not expected to receive its first delivery of planes until 2024. A lot of money is spent on weapons in the Middle East, not nearly as much on humanitarian aid. Today, the head of the World Food Program, David Beasley, singled out one country that desperately needs international support to feed its people, Yemen.
It is a disaster. We are supporting about 13 million people as we speak. About 8.9 million of them are getting half rations.
The impact can be seen in clinics across Yemen that specialize in treating malnutrition in young children. Aida Al-Sadiq is a medical doctor and assistant professor at the University of Aden in southern Yemen, and she joins us from Aden. Dr. Sadiq, for many years, you ran the child program at the Sadaka Hospital in Aden that treats children with malnutrition. How does malnutrition occur in children, and why does it happen?
Malnutrition is either primary malnutrition due to lack of food, which is most common in my country, or it could be secondary to underlying illnesses.
A documentary about malnutrition in Yemen has just come out. Yes. It's called Hunger Ward. And part of the film was shot at Sadaka Hospital. Yes. In Aden, in the nutrition clinic where you were working. You're in the film, and here's a scene from it.
Fatma, give me the bag.
We see an infant on a hospital bed. She's unconscious. You're there giving her compressions, and you call out for a breathing pump. It's very tense. Can you talk us through that moment? What do you remember from that day?
It was a very sad experience for me, because my work is to help people to survive, to resuscitate people, not to be lost. It's very painful for me, really. I cried at that time because I stood helpless. I felt I can't do anything for this life. That's why I saw the movie. It was very sad for me. Makes me remembering something I went through, which was very bad.
The infant died. What happened to the infant?
Yes, the infant died because, look, families here, because of ignorance, they brought their babies lately.
What happened, as I saw it, was to that infant was that a breathing pump was put in the infant's mouth, and I think a relative of the infant then tried to feed the boy.
Yes, she cried at that time. She started to blame other, but this is the case all the time.
It was very sad. Your work in that clinic, it goes on even as war continues in parts of Yemen, and economic troubles cause millions of Yemenis to live with hunger. I want to ask you, how much has this war affected the number and severity of malnutrition cases?
Yes, I did studies, many studies. Undernutrition and management outcome before and after 2015 armed crisis, it showed that before 2015 armed crisis, it was 23 or something like this, the severe acute malnutrition, the number doubled. This is accepted. This is a consequence of a war.
So it's become acceptable that this has gone on. Dr. Al-Sadiq, what would you like Americans to understand about how serious the problem of malnutrition is in Yemen among children?
American people or American administration or Biden administration?
Both.
People, we need your voice to speak to your administration, to help us not to support this war against Yemenis. Otherwise, you will see Yemen without Yemenis. It's very heartbreaking and painful.
Aida Al-Sadiq is a medical doctor and assistant professor at the University of Aden in southern Yemen. She was telling us about the problem of malnutrition in Yemeni children, the subject of a new film called Hunger Ward. Dr. Al-Sadiq, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks. Shukran.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. The EU's biggest oil producer has decided to call it quits. The Danish parliament voted this month to stop issuing new leases and end oil production by 2050. That will make Denmark the first major oil-producing country in the world to decide to phase out production. We're digging into their plan today on The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
I'm joined by Denmark's climate minister, Dan Jorgensen. Dan, what's the significance of this decision?
Well, it's a very big decision for us in Denmark. For decades, we have made a lot of money on oil and gas, and it's been an important part of the funding of our welfare state. But we feel that we need to take this decision because climate change is here, and we need to do whatever we can to fight it. And for us to argue with a credible voice that we are actually leaders in the fight against climate change, we needed to take this decision.
Now, your energy ministry estimates this could cost Denmark $2 billion in lost revenue. How do you intend to close that revenue gap?
Yeah, we need a new strategy now for how will we make a living in the future. Fortunately, we are already underway. We are in a situation now where renewables, especially wind and offshore wind, is already a much bigger sector than the oil sector. So we plan to keep expanding our renewable sector. We have planned to really ambitiously grow our offshore wind, for instance. So we hope to make up not only for the lost revenue, but also to create the jobs that will be lost in the oil sector.
Have you received any pushback for this decision to stop issuing new leases and end oil production?
It's obvious that not all companies in the oil sector and gas sector were happy about this, obviously. There's also been political forces saying that as long as there's oil down there, we should pull it out of the ground and make money on it. But all in all, I'm happy to say that we have broad support for this. And I think one of the reasons for that is that we are doing this in a just way. We want this to be a just transition, meaning that we really focus on creating jobs for the people that will lose their jobs. We focus on having a plan for economic development that makes this also economically a viable solution.
There's around 4,000 people who are employed by Denmark's oil and gas sector. How do you make up for that many jobs? Do the current plans cover that, or are you still sort of behind in terms of figuring out how to re-employ these people?
It's a great question, because very often in the debate about green transformation in general in Europe, people forget that, okay, yes, as a whole, the green transformation will give you more jobs than you'll lose. But it's very important for us that we find the right jobs for the people that will lose the job here. First of all, this is not something that we're going to do from one day to the next. Second important point is that we allocate funding to training a worker from somebody who works in offshore oil to offshore wind, for instance. The investments that we talked about earlier that we've made and will be making in offshore wind are quite substantial.
You mentioned 2050, and of course, that's the date you're going to end oil production. Greenpeace Denmark is applauding this move, and they're saying this is what climate leadership looks like. But you're also allowing three more decades of oil drilling of the current leases and production that's going on to continue in the North Sea. And that's something that youth climate activist Greta Thunberg has criticized on Twitter. How do you respond to activists who say 30 years is too slow for a phase out?
If we were to stop oil production tomorrow, for instance, as some activists have argued that we should, it would fundamentally change our entire society. We would no longer be able to fund our welfare state. hospitals, schools, roads, education system, all of these things would have to go through severe savings. So that, in my opinion, wouldn't really make us a front runner. I don't think many countries would then look at us and say, listen, that's a very good example. Let's follow that. I think it's important to be ambitious. And I think also that there's a reason why we choose to do this as the first major oil producing country. And that is that we want to and hope to inspire others. But if you want to hope to inspire others, then you also need to make rational decisions. And you also need to think about the people involved. For us, a just transition is a key term. It's important to find the balances. And I think we found that balance in the decision that we have made.
That's interesting. So you're really paying attention to also kind of social issues and political issues of how a population will respond and adapt to these changes.
I think one of the biggest threats and obstacles towards the green transformation that we need is if there's no public support. If we see too many problems where we don't take into consideration the needs and opinions of the population, both when installing renewable energy, but also when making the transformation from one type of energy to the next that might make people lose jobs, if we don't take that problem seriously and tackle it in a way that makes sure that we can maintain a society with a lot of equity and with no inequality, then I think we risk losing the support that we need.
Dan Jorgensen is the climate minister of Denmark. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We reported yesterday on a growing number of countries that are announcing they'll stop contributing greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by mid-century. Another country just added itself to that list, Brazil. This week, it said it would do its part by 2060. But it told the UN that it would not strengthen its goal for cutting carbon emissions in the near term, by the end of the decade. Experts say those short-term goals are necessary to lend credibility to long-term promises. Christian Poirier from the nonprofit Amazon Watch calls the target unambitious.
The announcement amounts to a baby step, and one from a government that has proven itself willing to sacrifice the Amazon and its peoples for quick profit, including the profit of illicit actors like illegal loggers, illegal miners, and land grabbers.
Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has pushed for more development in the Amazon. Deforestation there this year reached its highest level in more than a decade. Executive Secretary of the Climate Observatory in Brazil, Marcio Ostrini, says the government's plan is a shame.
Brazil was a kind of leader of this agenda in the past, and now we are on the side of the problem.
On the side of the problem. Brazil's communication to the UN also suggested that its target for 2060 would be contingent on international funding. While a coronavirus vaccine is on the horizon, most of us are still a ways off from getting our shot in the arm. Masks and social distancing remain critical. So what's next in reopening schools and workplaces? As part of our regular series of live discussions on the pandemic, join us tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern for a conversation with Harvard Healthy Buildings expert Joe Allen. That's Friday, noon Eastern, at theworld.org.
A reminder to our listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. It's always been our goal to bring you human-centered journalism that connects you with people and events beyond our borders. During this holiday season, when many of us can't meet in person, that human connection is more important than ever. Help us keep the show available to everybody across the globe with your gift of $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we reach our goal, you'll get an invite to a virtual party with all the incredible people who make this show possible. If you've considered donating but haven't actually done it yet, then today is a day to take intention and turn it into action, one we at the show will be deeply grateful for. Just head to theworld.org/give. Thank you.
Hummus, the Middle Eastern appetizer, has gone wild.
There are all these white bean hummuses and black bean hummuses, sweet potato hummus and pumpkin puree hummus.
Some say, make it stop.
Because it's absolutely perfect. You know, you wouldn't take a Kobe steak, for example, that's absolutely perfect, and then, you know, add ketchup to it.
tampering with food perfection. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More than 40 states and the federal government are now suing to break up Facebook. U.S. authorities announced the groundbreaking lawsuits just yesterday. Here's New York Attorney General Letitia James.
By using its vast troves of data and money, Facebook has squashed or hindered what the company perceived as potential threats. They've reduced choices for consumers. They stifled innovation, and they degraded privacy protections for millions of Americans.
These lawsuits could be the most dramatic antitrust action in decades, and not just here in the U.S., but worldwide. The World's Lydia Amanalidou covers tech for us. Lydia, what exactly are U.S. authorities alleging?
Yeah, so Carol, when we talk about Facebook, we have to remember we're talking about this three-headed giant. They own Instagram, that's a photo and video sharing app, as well as WhatsApp, which is a messaging tool. Facebook acquired these companies over the last decade, and now they've grown to become some of the most popular platforms all over the world. Altogether, they have an estimated 3 billion users worldwide, and federal and state officials in the U.S. say that's just too big, and that in the process, it's abused its power to crush smaller competitors. And through these lawsuits, they want to break up the company. They want to force Facebook to sell off WhatsApp and Instagram.
This isn't the first time the government has gone after big tech, is it?
Yeah, this is actually the second major antitrust action the U.S. has taken. In October, the Department of Justice, the DOJ, and several states sued Google. And the accusation there was that Google has an illegal monopoly over internet search and online advertising. So the experts say that taken together, these are the most significant antitrust cases in decades worldwide, not just in the U.S.
Lydia, as you know, Europe is typically seen as a leader on this issue. How are they viewing what's going on in the U.S.?
Yeah, I spoke about this with Thomas Vignat. He's a lawyer in Brussels who's been involved with several high-profile antitrust cases against tech companies in the U.S. and Europe. And he said that what's ironic here is that for several decades now, some in the U.S., especially on the Republican side, have been complaining about Europe going after these American tech icons.
And now we have the U.S. government taking a far more aggressive approach than the Europeans have ever taken.
And Vignat said that people in his circles in Europe are really surprised about this, that many people didn't expect the U.S. to go after tech companies so aggressively. And he said there's also some envy. So even though European authorities technically and legally would have the power to go after Facebook and other companies to try and break them up, he said they would never actually do that for political reasons.
Remind us, what have European authorities done on antitrust?
So the way they've gone after these companies is through fines. Just to give you an example, Google alone has gotten more than $9 billion in antitrust fines since 2017. And that amount to you and me, Carol, might seem huge. But for these tech giants, this is just the cost of doing business. And there's agreement that these fines, however big they might be, don't actually change the way these companies behave. Whereas trying to break up companies like Facebook, which is what the U.S. is doing, could actually change some behaviors.
Does this mean that the U.S. is now ahead of Europe when it comes to antitrust enforcement?
Yes and no. So most people would agree that what the U.S. is doing right now with these lawsuits, that it's far more aggressive than what European antitrust enforcers have done. But where the U.S. seems to be lagging behind is on serious legislation on antitrust. So right now, Europe is in the process of overhauling its antitrust rules. The European Commission is going to unveil a whole new framework on antitrust on Tuesday next week. And people like Vignat, the lawyer in Brussels, they say that Europe will be leaping ahead of the U.S. in that front and really leaping ahead of the rest of the world.
How is Facebook responding to all this?
In general, Facebook has argued that it doesn't have the kind of market dominance that its critics claim it has. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg actually made this point at a congressional hearing on antitrust over the summer. Here he is.
The fastest growing ads platform is Amazon. The largest ads platform is Google. And for every dollar spent on advertising in the U.S., less than 10 cents is...
And he went on to mention other companies. Now, in terms of the lawsuits this week, Facebook says that it disagrees with the government's allegations and that it plans to fight this in court.
The World's Lydia Amanalidou. Thanks a lot, Lydia.
You're welcome, Carol.
A few weeks ago, Oregon voters made a bold move. They voted to make their state the first to decriminalize possession of small amounts of hard drugs, substances like heroin, meth, or cocaine. A big step here in the U.S., but Oregon is actually pulling directly from the playbook of another country, Portugal. The question, though, can Portugal's experience translate to the Pacific Northwest? The World's Alana Gordon brings us a story from Portugal's capital, Lisbon.
The overgrown area off a side road in the north seems abandoned at first. It's not.
Hello.
Right before the pandemic hit, I joined an outreach team from the nonprofit Crescer that includes Inês Marinho, a nurse, and João Vicente, a peer.
Queres mais alguma coisa para os kits?
They spend their days stopping by different spots in Lisbon where people may use drugs, whether that's here or underneath subway terminals, to offer supplies like clean needles and health resources. They're part of a collection of services meant to support people who use drugs. Usen says the goal isn't to force anyone into treatment.
Para mim não funciona. Funciona é quando uma pessoa quer, não é de obriga.
Personally, I think it works only when someone wants to do something. If they try to force me to do something, it doesn't work. It depends on the will of the subject.
A man wearing sunglasses, jeans, and a nice blue jacket approaches us from a hidden dirt path and introduces himself. He says he's a lawyer and he comes here to smoke cocaine.
I give my face because I don't have shame to have a disease. Why? Why? I can choose other type of life because I like it.
Everything was built based in the idea that we were dealing with a health condition rather than a criminal one.
This is Dr. João Goulao, Portugal's drug czar. 20 years ago, he helped overhaul the country's approach to drugs. It was based on the idea that
the key intervention should be on the health and the social side rather than in the law enforcement and police and the supply side.
Goulao says Portugal's unconventional shift came out of a period in the 80s and 90s when the country was in the midst of a major drug crisis. Drug-related HIV and hepatitis C rates soared, the highest in Europe.
At the time, we used to have at least one overdose death a day.
The problem began after a democratic revolution in the 1970s reopened Portugal's borders. Drugs flooded into communities struggling with the transition and economic uncertainty. As a doctor, Goulao was himself flooded with people seeking help. He became a leader in the addiction field, and the government tapped him to join a team to overhaul the system.
We developed the responses in several areas, in prevention, in treatment, in harm reduction.
Goulao says they really expanded services for people who use drugs, offering easy ways to get things like methadone, housing, inpatient treatment, counseling. They also wanted to lift the stigma of addiction. So they decriminalized all drugs, meaning drugs are still illegal. But if police catch a person with less than a 10-day supply, there's no arrest, no jail time, not even a criminal record, just a citation, like driving without a seatbelt, and a referral to the Commission for the Dissuasion of Drug Addiction. The one in central Lisbon is in an office building, and its only mark is a small sign by the elevator and door. Inside, just a handful of people are waiting on a Monday morning when I stop in, including 22-year-old Daniel Martins da Cuesta.
I was caught with 0.27 Gs of hash.
Da Cuesta says police stopped and searched him and his friends a couple nights before.
I was angry.
So here he is to meet with the commission. This may seem like a daunting thing, but it's not.
The commission is very informal, and that was on purpose.
Nuno Capaz is a sociologist by training and has been running this commission since the beginning. He's wearing a sweatshirt, jeans, and Adidas sneakers. He says he wants people to feel comfortable here.
So it's one of the frontline connection points. And in order to establish that connection with users, we need to remove all those formalities that normally are associated with the court and the criminal system, and all the uniforms and all the rules.
20 of these commissions were set up around Portugal as part of the overhaul. They're typically made up of a health worker, a social worker, and a lawyer. Notably absent, law enforcement. Within minutes, da Cuesta's out of his meeting. He says he was asked,
if I still smoke, all regular, if I intend to stop.
What did you say?
I said no. And they asked me if I want help. I said no too. They said I have to tenho me inscrever no centro de emprego.
Go to a job center. He says he's been meaning to go there for some time. So that part?
No, it's a good thing.
All of these referrals are voluntary. And yet, since Portugal decriminalized drugs 20 years ago, the nation has not experienced a huge surge in addiction, as some feared. Gulau, the drug czar, says the opposite happened.
Nowadays, for every 10 drug users, we have one problematic user.
The overdoses dropped, as did HIV.
Big numbers, the big problems that we were facing at the time, we had huge improvements in the situation.
But the direct nature of these shifts can be hard for researchers to fully link to decriminalization. The country also created a social welfare and universal health system during that period. But Portugal continues to garner attention around the world as more and more countries face a growing drug crisis and are looking for solutions. Tashia Naidu is with the U.S. advocacy group, the Drug Policy Alliance.
I mean, it's not possible to exactly replicate Portugal in the United States.
But Naidu says she was trying to get as close as possible to it when she helped design Oregon's new decriminalization policy, the one that voters approved this fall.
What we can do is learn from what are the key components of Portugal's success and how can we replicate those components to the extent we're able to here.
Under Oregon's plan, tax revenue from its legal marijuana industry will be redirected to overhaul addiction services. Instead of facing arrest and a criminal record for personal drug use, people will get a citation, a fine, and a referral to a health screening.
Where your various needs are assessed, and then you could be provided with linkages or connections to the various services.
Some worry there won't be enough funding to pull this off in the way Portugal could. Others oppose removing power from the courts and directing people to treatment. The Oregon experiment to see whether the lessons from Portugal can actually translate across the Atlantic begins in the state early next year. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
This story is part of a reporting fellowship sponsored by the Association of Healthcare Journalists and supported by the Commonwealth Fund. As for a lighter drug, medical marijuana has come to be accepted in many countries in recent years. But for recreational marijuana, it's been a slow and winding road. Here in the U.S., the House of Representatives approved a bill that would decriminalize marijuana on the federal level. It's almost guaranteed to languish in the Senate. In Mexico this week, lawmakers punted on a bill that would legalize weed for medicinal as well as recreational use. But as the world's Jorge Valencia reports from Mexico City, the mere fact that lawmakers are even considering the move is seen as a major breakthrough.
The Senate buildings in Mexico City take up an entire block near downtown. And this year, activists did something bold. They planted dozens of marijuana plants in the flower beds right outside the Senate. Some of them have grown more than 6 feet tall.
Hola, buenas tardes. Hola, ¿cómo están? Buenas tardes.
On this particular afternoon, there are a few dozen people smoking joints out here. It's an ongoing sit-in.
Mucho gusto. ¿Cómo te llamas? ¿Cuál es tu nombre y tu apellido?
I meet these two guys wearing dress shirts.
Dante.
Dante Hernandez says he lives in a suburb of Mexico City.
Llevo varios años fumando marihuana y esta es la primera vez que fumo en la calle.
He says he's been smoking marijuana for a few years, and this is the first time he lit up in public.
Prefiero hacerlo en privado, donde no molesto a nadie.
He'd rather smoke in private, he tells me, where he's not bothering anyone. But activists have long been lobbying Mexico's Congress to legalize marijuana. And this garden and the de facto decriminalization zone around it is part of the effort to pressure the Senate.
Senadoras, senadores, al pueblo de México.
Inside the Senate chamber, lawmakers took up legislation to legalize cannabis just a few weeks ago. Senator Julio Román Machaca Salazar addressed the floor.
Sin lugar a dudas, este dictamen va a ser uno de los más polémicos.
This is without a doubt one of the most controversial bills before lawmakers this year, Menchaca Salazar said. The proposal would allow adults to carry an ounce of weed, roughly the equivalent of a pack of cigarettes, and to grow as many as 6 plants at home.
Señor presidente, conforme al registro en el sistema electrónico se emitieron 72 votos a favor en el tablero.
Senators approved the measure in a 72-13 vote. Some of them held up alarm clocks with signs saying it's time to legalize.
En consecuencia, quedan aprobados los artículos reservados de la Ley Federal para la Regulación del Cannabis.
Senate President Oscar Eduardo Ramirez Aguilar carried a handkerchief with a marijuana leaf on it as he read the vote. He then sent the bill to the lower chamber of Congress.
It was very meaningful. I think it's a historic step that Mexico is taking in the right direction.
Zara Snap is a co-founder of Instituto RIA, a marijuana research and advocacy organization.
But it was also bittersweet because there are things that we would have done better, we think.
In fact, marijuana advocates have mixed feelings about all this. Snap says the current proposal favors corporations over small growers, and she says the penalties for carrying more than an ounce make marijuana holders vulnerable to police extortion. It's not clear what will happen in Mexico's lower chamber of Congress, but there is some support for wider legalization, says Congressman Sergio Pérez Hernández. Pérez Hernández says full decriminalization is necessary for the marijuana industry to flourish in Mexico. And he says lawmakers owe it to medical users to make marijuana more accessible. He's talking about ordinary people, like Haneli López's son.
Diego es un paciente con discapacidad múltiple, completamente.
López takes care of her son Diego full-time. He's 8 years old, he has multiple disabilities, he used to suffer from seizures several times every day, and he's also a regular kid. He likes to watch SpongeBob SquarePants and has a Labrador named Rox.
Si lo hace llorar alguien, se para en posición de ataque.
If anyone makes Diego cry, López says, Rox positions to attack. A real game changer for the López family came 3 years ago. That's when López began giving Diego marijuana oil extract. It really helped with the seizures, and López says it's improved Diego's quality of life.
Y de repente se empezó a reír, y efectivamente Diego estaba viendo la tele.
López says Diego began laughing and responding to what he would see on TV. But she says she had to get the oil extract illegally, and that the legislation making its way through Congress right now would not provide immediate relief for Diego or other medical marijuana users.
Incompleta porque toca seguir abriendo puertas para.
The legalization bill feels incomplete, López says, because we have to keep advocating for our children's needs. Mexico's Chamber of Deputies was scheduled to take up the legislation next week. They have now postponed a vote until February. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Picture this. You're in a remote part of the Amazon rainforest. You've been trekking for hours. Suddenly, you come across a giant rock face covered with ancient paintings. That's what a team of archaeologists uncovered recently in Colombia, miles of paintings, some dating back 12,000 years. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with Mark Robinson, an archaeologist at the University of Exeter in the UK who was part of that team. Marco asked Robinson to describe what you see when you stand right in front of those paintings.
The thing that leaps out is just the sheer extent of them and the color. They're so vibrant. Now, as your eye starts to adjust to them, you start to pick out the individual images. And there are a range of sizes from giant depictions down to very small, really minute, with quite fine detail. But the thing that really leaps out immediately is the depiction of the animals. And there's a range of animals from these large beasts with trunks to things like horses, which went extinct in the Americas over 10,000 years ago.
And something else we should point out about this rock face where you found these paintings, many of these paintings are way high up, so high that gathered many of them had to be photographed using drones. I mean, do you have any idea how artists thousands of years ago were able to paint them that high up?
The actual ability to paint in these more inaccessible locations is not such a mystery. There's enough jungle products out there from trees and vines which can easily bind together, and you can make a ladder very quickly. For me, the more interesting thing is, why did they put it into these locations? They're no longer visible from the ground. They're no longer visible from anywhere, really. So who are they making these paintings for? Is it tagging something because it is hard, or is it more of an offering? An offering to earth deities, to ancestors, to some kind of concept of their god. It's a fascinating thing to look into further as we start to look at the spatial patterning of these images.
The word discovery is being used here, Mark. I know this is a remote site, but do we know if people living in the surrounding areas knew these paintings were there?
So there's some known rock art in the area. Now, the sites we went to, we worked with the local community and we worked with some local guides. They had no knowledge of the new panels we found. So as far as we know, this is certainly a new discovery to science and to the wider world. And this adds a huge amount to the corpus, the actual whole assemblage of art we have in the region. And we've just scratched the surface.
So we're talking about a very exciting discovery of paintings that are perhaps 12,000 years old. How significant is this?
Art's really important to humanity. It's a core part of what makes us human. So having such a large corpus of art from a region and which dates back so early to the very first Americans, it's just priceless. It's got so much potential to understand who we are as a species. Now, beyond that, the actual scientific side, as we start to understand these people and their impact on the environment and the landscapes, is massive. The interactions they had with the landscape around them, with the animals, with the plants, this is what set forth the whole biodiversity that is the Amazon. It's the most biodiverse location on the planet. And yet people were there right from the beginning, as it's establishing, before it's even a full tropical forest. People are there manipulating plants. They're manipulating animals. They're hunting. They're setting fires. This all has an impact on how vegetation grows and how habitats change over time. And we're going to look deeper and deeper into how people have really influenced these kind of global systems.
Mark Robinson is an archaeologist at the University of Exeter. He was part of the team that uncovered extensive ancient paintings on a rock face in the Amazon in Colombia. Great to have you with us, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Horrific Frankenstein versions of the Middle Eastern meze. That's how my next guest, Karim Shaheen, describes the varieties of hummus that have been popping up in recent years. Dark chocolate mint dessert hummus, anyone? What about cilantro and jalapeno? No thanks, says Shaheen, who's been writing about this for The National, a news outlet based in the United Arab Emirates. He joins me now from Montreal. Karim, let's start with the very basics. What is hummus?
Hummus is a Levantine dip. It's a very popular meze or appetizer in the Middle East. It's made of pureed chickpeas and tahini and lemon and olive oil and a little bit of garlic. And sometimes it's topped with meat or pine nuts or simply olive oil. And it's enjoyed in a wide variety of countries in the region.
So why do you think that basic recipe shouldn't be tampered with?
Because it's absolutely perfect. It's, you know, you wouldn't take, you know, an original recipe of anything, anything that already exists as a, you know, perfect version of itself, and then go ahead and tamper with it. You wouldn't take a Kobe steak, for example, that's absolutely perfect, and then, you know, add ketchup to it. These variants are really interesting. You know, the one that you mentioned at the start, the dark chocolate mint dessert hummus. In addition to not making any sense, it also, you know, is one of those things that simply adheres to a Western palate that is developing right now and caters to, you know, all these various fad diets. And in addition to that, you know, this sort of consumerism that that creates, you know, adulterated versions of these original recipes really robs them of their authenticity. You know, it's fascinating to see these two different competing trends when it comes to food, right? One is that we're constantly looking for novelty and for different takes on, you know, existing products and existing things that have for a long time been part of our culture. But at the same time, we're also always striving for originality and authenticity in our experiences. And those two values are really clashing in this hummus debate. The argument I'm trying to make is that, you know, you can go ahead and experiment as much as you want with whatever food you want to play around with, but it's just not hummus.
I'm sensing that you think that the kind of takeoffs on hummus are a bit of cultural appropriation. Am I right?
Well, you know, to a certain extent, I suppose it is. I for me, the primary objection to the whole thing is just that it's really bad taste. the way a lot of French people are very particular about the exact way you consume croissants. You know, Italians will refuse to serve you cappuccinos in the afternoon. There need to be some limits. There need to be some, you know, the proper way of consuming things.
So, Karim, this sounds really personal for you.
You know what? It is. Part of the experience of being an immigrant, and I am an immigrant now, you know, is the idea of like preserving some of the things from home that make you who you are. You know, we cling to some of these you know, cultural products as they existed in their unadulterated form.
Okay, I have to ask, what's your favorite hummus recipe?
there's primarily two ways of eating hummus. One is an appetizer, and it's, you know, it's usually topped with olive oil, and you'll see it in most Middle Eastern mezze spreads. The other one is more of a fuller meal. Essentially, it's a hummus dish topped with meat and pine nuts and toasted pine nuts with piping hot ghee. And if you eat that, that's basically a full meal, and you should try not to do anything else in the immediate aftermath because you won't be able to.
Karim Shaheen is a writer based in Montreal. He's been talking with us about the many unconventional takes on the humble but beloved hummus. Karim, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, now I'm hungry.
I am too.
And with that, it's time to go. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.